Today in Studio 360, love is in the air, but not everybody's feeling it.
My novelist's prompt and voluble good cheer in the morning strains my very last nerve.
A novelist and a poet, husband and wife, challenge each other to a literary duel, and it's getting kind of ugly.
If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
And love will tear us apart.
Plus, our special correspondent Fiona Chutney is back looking for a great date outfit for Valentine's Day.
Here we are, here we go.
So, she hits the runways of New York's Fashion Week.
Very interesting walk. They look like question marks. They lead with their crotch.
Brace yourself for fabulousness. All ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, we'll listen in on a war of words between a novelist and a poet who are married to each other. And hear some brand new custom-composed love songs, including one, Yikes, for my wife and me. But first, it's New York Fashion Week. Twice a year, 80 of the biggest-time designers from around America and the world come to New York to show their work on runways in front of invitation-only fashion crowds. It's a spectacle to see and, even more, to be seen at. And we sent Studio 360's very fashion-curious cultural correspondent, who goes by the name of Fiona Chutney, to cover it.
Oh, all right. Here we are. On a blisteringly rainy day in New York City, walking towards Bryant Park. There are about five massive white tents. There's a line. A lot of these girls are wearing red. They look like little Twizzlers walking around. Very tall, you know, your standard anorexic, you know, 6'9". It's going to be fantastic. We're on our way to get our press credentials. I'm wearing my Sunday best. I have my yellow Lipton umbrella, which I always take out for festive occasions. I've got my little, my Pumas. And I'm wearing a puffy marshmallow jacket. I look like the Michelin man in my yellow umbrella. But you know what? I'm real.
And Fiona Chutney is back from the fashion front lines and here with me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm so happy to be here. I feel like a battered soldier.
Really?
And I'm not what you would call a master of fashion, Kurt. I mean, as a child, my mother forced me to wear my deceased grandmother's clothing. Taupe jumpsuits, sensible unitards and the like.
But they let you in.
They did let me in. There were lots of bouncers. It was very high security. You know, there's a lot going on. It's like a nuclear reactor in there at Bryant Park. But these bouncers were very warm and welcoming. They all seemed to have been culled from the Gambino crime family. Hi, how are you?
Good. Where are you from?
I'm all over the world. I'm global.
Where are you from?
I'm a global citizen.
Where are you from?
Well, I was born in South Africa and then I moved through.
Nice.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. How long have you been working here?
This is my 13th season.
13th season. And is this the usual crowd?
Yes.
They seem
absolutely
a little persnickety.
They're all snickety, whatever that means,
little,
but they are.
Yeah.
I think I know what it means, but they are snickety.
You know what I mean, persnickety. Like, yeah. There's some stores. Is there like a single scene? Is
no.
Anyone straight? Do you think I could point anyone straight here for me? We're nearing Valentine's Day, and you know, I came here hoping to find maybe some sort of outfit.
I got to go for a colonoscopy on Valentine's Day. It looks like a date. Yeah, clean myself
I've
out.
I've had a colonoscopy. It's fantastic.
Oh, I had six of them.
Oh, you had six. You're a veteran.
Yeah, I like it. I
had one.
Yeah,
that Valium drip is fantastic.
Yes.
All right, we're going to go see what's going on in the Mercedes Lounge. Cheers.
Okay,
thank
enjoy.
You. I'm a multitasker, Kurt, and I actually went with two goals in mind, to see the fashions and to actually find an outfit for Valentine's Day.
Really?
Yeah.
You have a date?
Well, I actually have nine dates, Kurt.
Nine dates?
I have nine dates. I actually enrolled in a thing called the Lonely Hearts Speed Dating Program. I got an email, and it's basically a moving platform where they kind of thrust different men at you in a three-second interval, kind of like the
human dim sum.
The human dim sum or the sushi, whatever your, you know, whatever your fancy.
Yeah.
I was a little concerned because I don't know too much about fashion, and then luckily someone guided me to see Patricia Field.
Field.
Uh-huh.
Do you know who she is?
She's a stylist, a TV costume designer for Sex and the City.
Exactly. Yeah, and right. I ran over to talk to her, you know, thinking that she'd be a very warm, welcoming presence that could guide me.
How do you do,
good,
Fiona?
Good. We're very excited. It's our first Fashion Week. And we wanted to know what inspires you. Like, how do you choose your clothing? Certain designers you like to work with and things like that. No, you just pick anybody.
This is not fashion. This is movies.
Right, so it's costume design.
It happens that my specialty is fashion in movies. It's costume design, exactly.
Right.
It's not fashion. I'm not selling clothes. I'm telling stories.
Right, well, you inspire me.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that I do.
I'm trying to move beyond grey, but it's going to happen once I get, you know,
more confident. You don't look like I inspire.
Oh, well, you know, that's why we're here. We're in Fashion Week here, and we're trying to, you know, I'm trying to delve into a new world.
Well, right after Patricia Field, and after the tears subsided and I kind of regrouped, we actually went to see our first show, the Ducky Brown show, which was a male menswear.
Ducky Brown is the name of a designer?
It is, maybe two or three. It's, you know, it's quirky, it's for ducky. You know, who doesn't want to wear a ducky suit?
Oh, very, very fashion forward, techno cratic music here. Oh, the bass is pounding. I'm getting very excited. This is going to be very, very hot. Very hot.
It was a very interesting show. There was very loud trance music blasting, but once the models came out, it was completely silent.
This boy looks like he's about to go to boarding school. He's wearing some sort of jacket and a backpack, a very sensible backpack that probably costs $10,000. Well, this dollar today is probably like €2.
And I thought that was a mistake, but afterwards I talked to extremely beautiful man who turned out to be a very big model, apparently, Tyson Beckford.
Oh, yes, even I've heard of him.
Have you really?
Yeah.
He's beautiful and very nice and very sweet. And then I definitely recorded. I mean, I saw him, I said, press
record. Let's listen. And was he inspiring as well?
Oh, he was more than inspiring, Kurt.
Oh, I didn't mean to, I won't pull on you, I won't touch you. You can touch me if you like. You can't keep your hands off me. But now, are you covering this just for yourself? Are you looking for your own clothes?
You know, I'm trying to find the designers that are supporting the black images on the runways, because we don't have that anymore. So that's what, you know.
And did he support the black image?
Yes, he did. He
how
sure
did he
did.
Do that?
Look at how many diverse young men he had on there. It wasn't
he had
just
some Latinos, too. Very
guys.
Cute.
Yes, he did.
Very nice.
And it was great the way he laid it out. And I love the fact he didn't have any music. I thought it was brilliant. So
I know. It's my first
Fashion
Week.
The little credit that we get as... Oh, is it your first
yeah,
one?
Yeah, you can tell I'm just dressed up for the
you've
occasion.
Been de-virginized
thank
now.
You. I have a little bit. Well, not, I'm still kind of a virgin the other ways. Thank
right?
you, Tyson.
Right.
Call me later.
Well, we're in the other tent now, the promenade. I'm still feeling a little giddy after talking to Tyson Beckford. Very lovely, very flirty. I mean, he could not keep his eyes off me. But right now we're in Rubin Singer, who apparently comes from a long line of Soviet designers. Apparently his aunt or his grandfather designed clothing for Stalin. I had no idea that Stalin was a fashion whore. Here we are, here we go. Very interesting walk. They look like question marks. They lead with their crotch. I love how serious they look. They're like, we are saving the world. We are wearing a grey, form-fitting dress, and I am curing cancer. It's got that very... It could not be more serious or fun. She's walking horribly. Walks like my grandmother, Ethel. She does. She has this walk that Ethel had in her later years, where she wasn't sure she was still alive, but she kept checking. You can actually count the ribs from the front and the back. Look at this one. You can actually see. It's quite an anatomy lesson, actually. It's like that bodies exhibit. You can actually see the internal organs walking down the runway. Oh, there's the pancreas. Oh, look, the spleen is in full form. Quite lovely. Oh, wow. A black tutu with a black leather jacket with her breasts flying out of the jacket. That's something I might want to consider for my speed dating endeavor.
So after seeing dozens of these brand new fall 2008 outfits, did you find something?
I actually found some great outfits. Like, I'm taking the black tutu with the black bustier. They have to tailor it, you know, widen it, lengthen it, shorten it where necessary.
It could be a mistake for you.
You think? It's interesting. Now that I think about it, it's like, initially when I went in, I was like, this is who I am, and I'm here, and I don't care who you are, I'm going to be me. And then you know, 19 minutes later, I'm ready to sell my soul for a gold lamé mesh tank top top bottom combination. And maybe you're right. Maybe I need to go to the speed dating endeavor the way I am, with my grandmother's jumper, with its smells, with its nostalgia, and be like, this is my, smell me. This is who I am. This is my history. If you want my history, come closer. And you know what? That's maybe what I'm going to do. I'm not sure yet. I still have to decide, see how, you know, talk to Tyson, see, consult. But maybe that's what I'll be doing. I'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Fiona. You can see some pictures of Fiona among the Fashion Week throng at studio360.org. By the way, Fiona Chutney is the invention of the American performer Iris Barr, whose one-woman show, Die Enough, is now running at the 47th Street Theater in New York City. Last Valentine's Day, just about a year ago now, the singer-songwriter Corey Dargle visited Studio 360. Corey is sort of a modern troubadour. He takes commissions for love songs.
I've always thought of my songs as first and foremost recordings that are listened to by one person at a time. And to me, this seemed like the next natural step for that, to write songs about specific individuals one at a time and to make those songs special for them.
Here's how it works. You write a page or so about your loved one and you send it to Corey, and then he turns it into a musical tribute.
So phone calls led to coffee, and coffee led to four-star dining, opera, cabaret, and the literati.
So we decided to offer you guys a chance to win a personalized love song from Corey Dargle by sending us your love stories. And they poured in. We heard from a woman going through a divorce who fell for her bankruptcy attorney, a wedding photographer whose fiancé broke off their engagement, two Mormons who left their church and their husbands and found each other. And then there was this one.
My sister and I are twins, but I've always taken that for granted. Our mother likes to tell stories of us as toddlers, walking around the house, completely engrossed in conversations, in a language strictly of our own making. Now that she's not here, I feel this dull ache inside whenever she pops into my consciousness.
That's our winner, Teresa Walsh. She's a 23-year-old from Santa Rosa, California, who wanted a song about her relationship with her twin sister, Katie, who'd gone off to college. So Corey took Teresa's note and composed a song for Katie. How do you think she will react to hearing the song and finding out that you've done this for her?
She's probably going to cry and then laugh a lot, hopefully.
We'll hear her sister's reaction in a minute. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. A year ago, in honor of Valentine's Day, we had a contest. We offered listeners a free love song composed and performed by indie rocker Corey Dargle. After reading a ton of sweet, sometimes sad, mostly compelling love stories, we chose a winner. And now, drumroll please, Corey Dargle's love song. From Teresa Walsh to her twin sister, Katie, who'd recently left for college. Now, Katie had no idea that there even was a competition.
When did this happen? How could you not tell me?
It was really, really hard not to tell you. This was like months ago.
I know sometimes my voice is in your head, telling you things you might rather leave unsaid.
Oh.
It's just that you're so much fun to talk to.
Oh my gosh, that's so sweet. Thank you so much. I don't even know what to say. I could say happy birthday. Happy birthday, Tree. Thank you so much. Aww.
You sat down next to me.
I was listening to the radio on my way home from work. Corey Dargle, they had him on, and he was playing a song for the person he interviewed about how they met and how they fell in love. And I'm sitting here crying in the car, like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. Then they announced the contest, and like, oh my God, I have to do this.
So, did you tell him all of my secrets, or...?
Not all of them. Okay, well,
that's cool, I guess. Wow. Jessica, I will stop listening to so much NPR. Okay, that may be the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. Oh, no!
We've always had different musical tastes. At the moment, I'm listening to a lot of like indie and bands that aren't really that popular, and Katie's always made me listen to like Motown, and I also have a grudging appreciation for Michael Jackson.
As kids, we really didn't get along, like kids growing up and in high school and stuff, but actually in the last few years, yeah, we've gotten a lot closer and like realized the importance of somebody, because like your sister is somebody that's been through all the same things as you, and there's not anybody else that can have the same perspective on things as, you know, your own sister. Plus, she reads me like a book, so if I ever need an honest opinion about something, I just call her, and she's brutal.
I'm so pleased with the song. I've been, you know, waiting to hear it for so long, and so excited and nervous, and I'm just so happy with the way it turned out. You know, I think it's something that we'll always share together. Like, I picture us listening to it on a birthday or something. And
yeah, that's definitely, I don't think anybody else could say that was their song, for sure. A little bit too personal there, but I really like it. I think it's awesome.
Teresa and Katie Walsh in Santa Rosa, California. You can see a picture of them at studio360.org.
I can't believe I won. Oh, my God.
And there is one more surprise in store from Corey Dargle. Could you write a song for me and my wife, do you think?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Cool. What do I need to tell you?
What's her name?
Her name is Anne.
Well, why don't you tell me about your first date?
It was a blind date, and my first and last blind date. Went to see Weird, Dissonant, Modern. Later on in the hour, against my better judgment, I will hear, and my wife will come in to hear, and all of you will hear the song that Corey has composed for us. I got married 26 years ago to a business person. But for the last 7 years, I've been married to a journalist and author, not because I married somebody new and switched careers. She and I do very different kinds of writing, so I was all ears when I heard about Naeem Murr and his wife. Naeem's a novelist. He is married to a poet. And a while ago, the Poetry Foundation in Chicago commissioned a story from him about what it's like to be married to a poet.
I've never understood poetry. You see, I'm a fiction writer. If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
Naeem wrote a very funny and honest and slightly antagonistic account of life with his poet wife. And we thought it's only right to hear the other side of the story from his wife, Avril Curdy.
For now, I will consider my novelist. For at dawn's grumbling of the L in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by grinding the beans and making me coffee. For in these few minutes, an elegantly fragrant silence reigns.
Loving my poet as I do, I try hard to understand what a poet is. The first clue lies in the fact that my poet, every poet, is an insomniac. A friend of mine, who's a literature professor, is very enamored of my poet, whom he describes tremblingly as the real thing. The real thing. He tells me he finds it profoundly reassuring that while we ordinary mortals are asleep, there exist lit rooms containing anxious, vigilant souls. A terrible responsibility, he says, devolves upon the poet that requires her never to be fully awake or asleep The world will end, he once told me, when the final poet awake closes her eyes. Last night I woke up sweating, having dreamed of sinking with the rest of humanity into cold oblivion. Sure enough, my poet was fast asleep beside me, the first deep sleep she'd entered in more than a week. So I knocked a pile of books to the floor and returned to my blissful slumbers, much comforted by the thought that at least one poet would wander the midnight battlements, keep watch, and preserve us all for one more day.
My novelist's prompt and voluble good cheer in the morning strains my very last nerve. For doesn't he know we are all going to die? As he senses the magnanimous motions of his muse beginning within, my novelist burps. Now lightened in spirit, he scrawls on the door to his office, "Writer at work, no girls allowed." For he weeps for his characters, then pokes his head into my office, smiling to ask,
"You're not working, are you?" Having written 36 pages or so this morning, I take a break and seek out my poet. She's in the sitting room, leaning her forehead hopelessly against the window pane, staring into the street. "Finished any poems?"
"Not today."
"What, no signal again?" I make the call me gesture and wander around the sitting room, saying, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" She tells me quietly that if I don't leave her alone, she's going to disembowel me with her pencil. I lay low for a bit, and then very quietly carry my chair into the sitting room. She's still staring out of the window, unmoved. I get up onto the chair with my manuscript, which I lift as high as I can, before dropping. "Oh, I didn't mean to disturb you," I say. "Just wanted to get a sense of the heft of this new novel. It's a whopper."
Always he asks of each of my poems, "But what does it mean?" "For a poem should not mean but be," I intone. For he says, "Yes, be pretty." "No, for I like poems oblique as the reverse of antique tapestries and hard enough to crack a tooth on." For my novelist adds that he prefers poems with a good clear moral, or a beautiful but disfigured nun, and a bit of the old boom-chaka-boom-chaka-boom-boom-boom. Still gyrating his hips and giggling, he makes oatmeal for breakfast. For he writes only 50 pages before breakfast, and so worries he's suffering writer's block, which he's pretty sure he caught from a toilet seat.
My poet actually did start to get the signal this morning and spent almost 6 hours scribbling in her notebook. The result? 10 lines on a single page. That page is now impaled upon her corkboard, trapped in a terrible limbo with her other poems in progress, some of them years old and countless drafts thick. I find her reading in her office and ask what her new poem is about.
"That starling we saw. The one trapped in the Amtrak station."
"And?"
"And that's what it's about."
"So a tale of triumph. Little guy against the corporate machine."
"No. Via negativa. Apophasis. I'm thinking of what it's not."
What is not?"
"What the starling is not."
She points at her corkboard.
"Why don't you just read it?"
I do. And for a moment I feel as if the top of my head has come off. Immediately followed by the rather unpleasant sensation that someone's rattling a stick around in there. "Whoa," I say. "Deep." I pretend to stagger for a while under the weight of its profundity. Feeling I've done my duty, I ask if I can tell her the plot of my new novel.
"If you must,"
she says, with that expression of desperate eagerness very particular to her, and strangely reminiscent of most people's expressions when they're not very eager at all. "A woman has 2 children, a boy and a girl." I start to cry but hold off. "And she dies from the cancer."
"What kind of cancer?"
"Cancer of the left ventricle. The key to good fiction is being specific." "And they all keen and grieve, and her son becomes a boxer because he's full of anger at God, and her daughter becomes a nun, chaste, but under her cassock..."
"Habit."
"What?"
"Nuns wear habits."
"Why are you saying things I can't understand?" "Anyway, her loveliness is wasted because her cassock catches fire and she becomes horribly disfigured."
"Stop!"
she shouts. "Mildly disfigured?"
"Just stop, please."
"A small scar that's actually quite becoming?"
"This is exactly the same as your other novel."
I can see she's in pain. My plots always move her. I don't get why poems can't have such stirring plots. Her poem is about what a starling is not. It seems to me that in a way all poems are about what a starling is not. Where's the passion, the triumph, human will overcoming tragedy and breaching the indifferent, where disfigured nuns cast off their cassocks to bear their beauty, where boxers beat men to a bloody pulp and cry up to heaven, "Here, here, damn you, is the work of my hands." A starling, I say.
A starling. Why don't I just pop them out, he wonders. For he writes the story, and I write the song of the story. Plot bores me. He can have it. For who wants to worry always about this and then that and then this, when we are all going to die?
I don't know if this is one of the reasons my professor friend calls her the real thing, but my poet loves words in a way that I feel is quite unhealthy and unnatural. She owns a dictionary decades old, and so large she uses a small buffet cart to wheel it around our apartment like some invalid relative. The secret to a poet's soul lies somewhere in the little cells of that dungeonish dictionary, in the slow languishing of those old, mad, forgotten words. It's also in the very particular kind of art she, and every poet, seems to love. Joseph Cornell. I guarantee you will not find a single poet who doesn't start rubbing herself against the furniture the minute you mention Cornell and his little boxes full of human residue, the pleasures of the miniature. One good thing, though, is that after we went to see the Cornell exhibit some years ago, I got the idea to give her, for her birthday, a tobacco box in which I glued lots of small objects, secret decoder rings, vintage bottle caps, my grandfather's glass eye. She gushed. Like a Cornell, I pointed out.
I love it because you made it.
It's just like a Cornell.
You usually just give me cash.
Isn't it exactly like a Cornell?
I love it. Thank you.
Since then, that's what I've given her for every present. Small things glued into boxes, shoe boxes, cereal boxes, bento boxes, Happy Meal boxes. She does seem a little less enthusiastic.
For he is my dream of an old house. In my dream, I have lived in this house for years. When I open a door I've never seen before and enter a room filled with comforts and curiosities, a fox's spine strung within a bell jar, a doll's head crowned by a hive of honeybees. For this is how it feels when I read my novelist's new book. For then my next poem, trembling now like the meniscus upon a glut cup, now full as a melting icicle's bleb showing the inverted world, my next poem will be an elegy infused with beauty and sorrow and the awareness that we are all going to die. For just write it, he says, spill it out, as though a poem is ever just written. Why don't I just write it? Well, I'll tell you. Because I am the cavalry charge into the cannon's maw, the winning run thrown out at home, the heroic yet impotent gesture.
My poet is in the sitting room with her forehead pressed to the window again. It's actually been a good week for us. I sold my new novel after a bidding war for $11 million, and my poet had a poem taken by a well-known literary journal, which gave payment in the form of an origami swan made out of her recycled submission. But I've been feeling contrite. I forgot our anniversary in January. Quietly, I approach my poet, who is lost in thought. In truth, health, riches, and a vast readership are as nothing compared to this moment. My poet turning to me, her face dilating beautifully as she murmurs like an approaching revelation. Glaucus. But her face soon clouds. Whatever it was didn't take hold, and the abortive flush of it leaves her sad and drawn. This seems a good time to hand her my anniversary gift. I'm sorry it's late. As she unwraps it, I walk away.
What's this?
She calls after me. A Cornell, I say.
Did you make it?
Oh no, that, I say, pointing back at her, at my genuine and indisputable poet. That is the real thing.
For it is Valentine's Day, and this morning a new poem, more visionary than Dante's Inferno, more definitive than The Wasteland, seeps into every cell of my body. when my novelist knocks on the door. For with a rose in his mouth and dressed only in a ribbon, he asks,
"You weren't planning to work today, were you?"
Naeem Murr's new novel is called The Perfect Man. Avril Curdy's poems have appeared in Slate, Poetry Magazine, and the Paris Review. They live and work in Chicago. Studio 360's Pike Malinowski produced our story.
And love, love will tear us apart again.
Do you happen to be an artist lashed up with another writer or painter, filmmaker? If so, tell us about your happy home at studio360.org.
Why is the bedroom so cold?
It's hard to imagine Naeem and Avril collaborating, but plenty of artist couples do. Like a couple in Miami who work under the name Guerra de la Paz. They take old pants and dresses and shirts and turn them into these gorgeous room-sized sculptures, giant trees and gardens of bright fabric, which have been exhibited and collected all over the world. Alicia Zuckerman caught up with the couple on a hunt for materials in Miami.
See, like, where am I going to find green pantyhose? Opaque green pantyhose. Gotta have it.
It's a sweltering day. The sun's beating down on Aline Guerra and Geraldo de la Paz. Sweat runs into their eyes as they reach into dumpsters filled with discarded clothing. They yank hard, pulling out old sweaters, polyester disco shirts, an army green rubber boot.
Whatever you find that you kind of can use, you just pull it.
The clothing comes to this warehouse from thrift shops all over the country. It's bound mostly for the Caribbean, but mountains of it, sometimes 15 feet high, get left behind in Miami. What are you holding? What did you pick up?
A pair of leopard stretch pants. We're making a tree out of leopard skin fabric right now. The trunk is all leopard. So what I'll do is I'll cut it into strips, and this will be a branch. This is our art supply store. Yeah, it's been good to us.
I'm the only person they've ever brought here, and to get them to do it, I had to promise not to reveal where it is. They drove me in their pickup truck and stopped just short of blindfolding me. Tell us where we are.
Well, we're not going to tell you.
Yeah, we're actually in an unincorporated area. So we're in the county, but there's no city involved.
It's one of the many little secrets of Miami.
Guerra de la Paz makes sculptures from old clothing, and just about all of their material comes from this warehouse. They say if other artists started showing up, it would take away the mystique. They both started out as painters. They're a couple, and they were already dating 12 years ago when they decided to share a studio in Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood.
It was a friendly thing to a point where we said, you know, why don't we try making something together?
Guerra and De La Paz would comment on each other's work all the time, and it turned out that usually their ideas were in sync. Soon they combined their careers and their names. They became Guerra de la Paz. That means War of the Peace in Spanish.
I think that was our first piece, was coming up with the name, and, you know, it was kind of a given, you know.
Both men were born in Cuba, but they say they left too young for it to have had any real influence on their work. What did and still does, says Guerra, is where they live now.
There's something about the light in Florida that everything is just so vibrant and everything just comes alive and it looks so lush. And that's the main reason why we started working with clothes. It was in huge abundance in the neighborhood.
A few years after they moved into their studio in Little Haiti, one of Miami's poorest neighborhoods, they started noticing all this clothing from the nearby exporting businesses caught in the barbed wire that ran along the tops of the chain link fences.
We would see it when it would rain, and all the colors would just be saturated, the brightest colors you could possibly find, and we just started trying to figure out how we could incorporate that material into what we do.
Some of their most remarkable installations, like the piece that they're unveiling for their solo show in New York next month, are dazzling room-sized landscapes. Oasis is one of their signature works. It was created for the Chicago Cultural Center. Garments in different shades of browns were knotted together and tied to ceiling rafters, forming massive banyan trees like the ones you see in South Florida. Grass and flowers made from t-shirts and socks sprouted up all around them. And in the middle of the room was a shimmering blue pond made from women's formal wear in layers of chiffon, sequins, and lamé. The curator said it made everything else in the building disappear. De La Paz says each garment is like a brushstroke.
And we look at these landscape installations kind of like the Impressionist paintings. They had all these color theories where they would put like an orange right under a blue to make the blue pop.
At the warehouse, going through the piles, it's almost like being in an archaeological dig. It's like pulling out things, and everything has a history and everything tells a story.
You know, a lot of this clothes, we air it out outside. Once we get it, we let it sit in the sun. But we do try not to wash, because I think that kind of washes away its history. But, you know, like if history smells too bad, it goes back into the pile. That's nice plaid.
For Studio 360, I'm Alicia Zuckerman in Miami.
Right now, Guerra de la Paz is setting up an installation at the Daniel Mahmoud Gallery here in New York. It opens on Valentine's Day. And you can see a slideshow of their work at studio360.org. Coming up, why is it that the most beautiful music is also often the saddest?
Even though there is a beloved, it's the lover and the pain of the lover that is the star of this show.
Love songs that'll break your heart, even if you don't speak Urdu. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you're looking for something a little less conventional for your Valentine, take a listen to some love songs from India and Pakistan. The music known as ghazal has roots in Persian poetry dating back to the 12th century. These days, artists like Najma Akhtar are blending the traditional with the modern, and that has caught the attention of world music connoisseurs, including Studio 360's Rob Weisberg.
I instantly fell for ghazal when I heard Najma. This record, Karib, became a world music sensation when it was released in 1987. Ghazal is actually a type of poem. It can just be recited, like they do at gatherings called mushaira, a tradition practiced in India, Pakistan, and places with South Asian emigre populations, including North America. But ghazals can be approached in many different ways musically. This is a ghazal styled according to Bollywood music conventions in an Indian film soundtrack. And here's one sung by the late great Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan with his Qawwali ensemble. Jagjit Singh, along with his wife Chitra Singh, were very influential in the 70s and 80s. They turned the ghazal into pop music.
Haseen thi
What makes these all ghazals? The basic structural ground rules are pretty clear. Kiran Alawalia, a ghazal singer from Toronto, explains.
The poetry is a series of couplets, and the couplets are not narrative. It's not a poem in which you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a lyrical poem.
The couplets are actually standalone, tiny poems. A ghazal is a collection of these couplets. You can write a ghazal about almost anything, but
if you want to talk about its central classical content, the perspective that's taken is basically that of a suffering lover who's passionately in love with an unavailable beloved.
That's Fran Pritchett, a Columbia University professor who specializes in the poetry of ghazal.
And everything in the ghazal almost is a reflection of how the world looks to that person.
Ghazals are about the state of the mind of the lover.
Kiran Alawalia knows this well. She has to play the part.
And this poetry is written mostly from the first person voice of a lover. And he's always either wooing the beloved or talking about the restlessness or the pain that he feels because he doesn't have access to this beloved. And the lover has basically left behind sanity and is willing to endure larger than life sacrifices for his beloved. And the beloved is always unattainable.
In ghazals, the lover, almost always male, gives up everything for his beloved, but is doomed to failure. And we're pulled down with him because
even though there is a beloved, it's the lover and the pain of the lover that is the star of this show. That's the star of a ghazal, is the lover, the fact that he can't have a beloved, and the pain that he's going through. And then this poetry is all about describing in wonderfully, wonderfully creative ways that pain and that angst and that restlessness of not being with your beloved.
Kiran deconstructs a couplet from one of the ghazals she sings, Sochka, to show how they function as discrete entities. The first line raises a question, the second provides a resolution.
One of the stanzas is saying, always keep cutting and pruning its branches. So that's just the first line. And right away you think, okay, well, which branches? Because before in the ghazal, we haven't heard of a tree or anything. So right away you're thinking, which branches? And the second question for me is, why should I always keep cutting and pruning? And it's the second sentence that resolves it. The second sentence is, otherwise, the tree of desires will again become thick. And so this is just a really beautiful way of depicting the pain and the angst of the lover. And in this couplet, it's basically saying, don't be an idealist, be a realist, by pruning your desires.
Ambiguity, wordplay, and double meaning are all characteristics of ghazal. Fran Pritchett shares an example from Ghalib, one of the greatest ghazal poets, who lived in the late 1800s.
Neend uski hai, dimaag uska hai, raatein uski hai. Translation, sleep is his, power of mind or intelligence is his, the nights are his. Whose? We have no idea. We have to wait until we get to the second line. Teri zulfein, your curls, jiske bazu par, on the shoulder of whom, pareshan, scattered, ho gayi, became.
On the surface, this sounds pretty sexy, not so unrequited. But Pritchett says it's all in the meaning, the double meaning of the word pareshan. That's an Urdu word with a Persian root.
Pareshan in Persian literally means scattered or dispersed, so that your curls on the shoulder of whom dispersed became clearly means the lucky man with whom you're sleeping, on whose shoulder your curls are all lying tangled and disarrayed. But pareshan in Urdu is almost always used sort of metaphorically by extension to mean anxious or distressed or in a state of worry and concern. So we realize that the whole first line has been giving us a perfect picture of the lover's pareshani, He's been completely parishan, distressed, because her curls are parishan, scattered on somebody else's shoulder.
A ghazal singer never wins. Now, as if the ghazal's romantic hopelessness wasn't sad enough, Kiran Ahluwalia has been experimenting with another form of music, the Portuguese song style called fado. For her new CD, Wanderlust, Kiran recorded three ghazals in Lisbon with fado guitarists.
When you are describing fado or ghazal, in the first three lines, you'll hear the words longing and yearning.
Misery, I suppose, loves company. For Studio 360, I'm Rob Weisberg.
You can hear another track from Kiran Ahluwalia at studio360.org. Earlier, we heard from love balladeer for hire, Corey Dargle. I asked Corey to write a song for my wife and me, both because I wanted to get in on the action myself and because we just celebrated the 30th anniversary of our first date. So I told Corey the story. It was back during the Carter administration. We were both fresh out of college and new to New York City. It was a blind date, my first.
Okay. Never done this.
When I got Anne into the studio to reveal this wacky scheme, I think she was slightly terrified.
Okay, God, I can't stand it.
I don't understand why this isn't like an exciting surprise.
Oh God, I have no idea.
So I'll tell you what we're doing. Okay. So there's this singer-songwriter named Corey Dargle. He's like a. After telling her what was up, she reacted like most people do when there's a surprise party in their honor. Pleased, but a little discombobulated, sheepish about suddenly being the center of attention. And so we have a song.
Okay.
About ourselves. I haven't heard it yet either.
Okay.
You're getting so emotional. Okay, let's listen.
Was my first blind date, and also my last. A boy and a girl from almost parallel states. A boy and a girl with almost parallel pasts. In fact, had I jumped into the Missouri River. And had it carried me down to Kansas City, I bet you would have rescued me before we started going gray. Before there was Lucy, before there was Kate, before our wedding day, and even before that first day. Jumped into the Missouri River in Omaha when I was 17, and let it carry me down to Kansas City. I bet you would have rescued me. I bet you would have rescued me.
That was awesome. It made me cry.
Really? It made me actually tear up at the beginning as well. It's entirely unlike what I imagined it would be, because I've heard several of his songs, and they weren't like this in the sense of making up the little fairy tale idea of, you know, jumping into the river. Which is pretty frightening to me, frankly.
It would have been a big river to rescue you from, too.
Yeah, and I would have, you know, died in Bellevue, Nebraska before I got there. But that's just my literal unromantic aspect coming up.
No, I loved it. It was pretty wonderful.
What will the kids think?
I think they'll be thrilled.
Yeah?
Completely.
Do you think we'll ever listen to it again?
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll put it on the iPod?
We should have it be our voicemail.
We could do that. We could do that. I mean, I guess it's a private thing, but not really. I mean, it would be just, it's like a conversation piece that we can play for people we know.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly siblings.
Somehow having it played on national radio makes it a little less private, I think.
Good point. You can hear more of Corey's love songs and read more love stories from listeners at studio360.org. While you're there, post a comment and tell us what you think of the show. And also sign up for our free weekly newsletter. And you can subscribe to the Studio 360 podcast. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening today, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Katie Rolnick,
Andrea Salenzi,
and Nat Wiener.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who support CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
He's 19 feet tall, marble, and kind of homely.
Lincoln is not the most classically beautiful face. You know, he was held in such esteem, but Lincoln is such a screwy-looking guy.
Join me and Sarah Vowell to figure out how the Lincoln Memorial became an American icon. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.